It is an interesting relationship with money we have in our culture. Compare different addictions, for example. A man who can't get enough to drink is an alcoholic. A man who can't get enough sex might be considered a womanizer or sex addict. A man who can't get enough money is considered a good businessman, and there doesn't seem to be an end to the current bull market. Plutomania is defined as an excessive desire for great wealth. Now, judging by the ads we're bombarded with, it seems as if Madison Avenue assumes we are all suffering from plutomania. The truth is that many people see that there is an emptiness in this way of living. There is an ache inside, and microwave ovens and cell phones can't seem to scratch that itch. For people who are awakening from their materialistic slumber, there are two words to consider. Voluntary simplicity. Cecile Andrews is a Seattle woman who teaches this, writes about it, and most importantly, lives in voluntary simplicity. And she's my guest today to talk about her work and her new book, The Circle of Simplicity, Return to the Good Life. Cecile, a pleasure to have you on the show.
Hi, Paul.
Enjoy your work a great deal. Seattle Times, is that Seattle Times, the article. Is that syndicated in other markets?
No, just Seattle.
So far?
Yeah.
Right. You know, before we get started in discussing your story, let's set up the current levels of the disease in our country. And I think you were, judging by the way you were smiling during my intro, you kind of agree with that. There's a statistic in your book that says per capita consumption has gone up 45% in the last 20 years. That stat just blew me away. And this seems to go hand in hand with the personal debt, which has also skyrocketed in that last 20 years. Are these the key stats, or do you see any other statistics which really tell the story for you?
Well, you know, I think even if you didn't know the statistics, just being around people, what people spend most of their time doing is either at the shopping malls or they're watching television, which is telling them to go shop. And so, or listening to people, what they talk about. They talk about what they've just bought. They talk about their TV friends, you know, that like they're real people. So even if you didn't know that statistic, you'd know that that's what people are doing. Buying stuff.
And that's indicative of, wait a minute, isn't there a lot better stuff to be doing with your life than buying? You're going to be on your deathbed wondering what happened to your life. And that, in a sense, could have happened to you if it weren't for a couple of events in your life, which you chronicle in the book. And I want to talk those events, specifically the Native American speaker who moved you to tears. But before we get into that, let's talk about voluntary simplicity itself, because we're throwing this around as if everybody knows it, and I don't think they do. So if you could, number one, define it, number two, tell us a little bit about the history of the movement.
Well, voluntary simplicity is really difficult to define, and I like to, one of my friends said that she was talking to somebody, her coworkers, about voluntary simplicity, and they said, aren't those the people who eat dirt? And so, and then another person said, he said, what's that thing your friend Cecile is involved in, that self-deprivation movement? So there are some misconceptions out there. But the big thing is it's like people are figuring out that they're not really happy the way we're living. And so they're stopping to think about it. And why aren't we happy? And so people have talked about voluntary simplicity as if they say outwardly simple and inwardly rich, less is more, living consciously so you can live fully, high fulfillment life with a low environmental impact. It's all taking a look at, what am I really doing? Is it making me happy? Is it ruining the environment? So it's really living consciously. That's the voluntary part in the simplicity. So people cut back in what they buy, and maybe they can cut back then in how much they work. And they do it not so they can like watch more TV, but so they can get more involved in something that makes them feel alive.
Yeah, something that really, it's something that has a soul, strong soul connection.
Right. Yeah, and that's the phrase that people respond to the most when I give workshops. They talk about, it's an Albert Schweitzer term, the sleeping sickness of the soul. And you say that and people know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. Perhaps a little bit about the history. Right here in Seattle, I guess, is sort of the birthplace of it, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting because some people look at this as a trend, but it is really something that has been around, of course, through human history. You know, all the great religions, people, the wise thinkers, talk about simplicity. But it's been particularly relevant to our country all the way through. The founding mothers and fathers talked about frugality and simplicity. Certainly, we know about Thoreau, and that was his main thing, the mass of men lead lives of, what is it, desperation. And then, of course, in the 60s. And then it's taken a rebirth, particularly in Seattle. And I think it's very, very interesting to speculate, why Seattle? Why is it just, you know, we have just a huge response here as compared to other places? Maybe it's, I don't know, we still care about the environment because we still have some of it. A lot of people came to Seattle because they wanted a different lifestyle, so they're still very conscious about it. I was at a conference recently in New York, and we did have a good response. I was surprised. But Seattle seems to be the leader.
You come to the upper left-hand corner of the country, and there's nowhere to look but inside. And you look inside, and you realize, you know, having the third answering machine for my fourth car's cell phone, you know, it's, wait a second, it's not making me happy.
Yeah. But maybe it's because we are more in touch with nature. And if you're more in touch with nature, maybe you feel more alive, and you're weighing what you're doing more than just responding to what the commercials are telling you to do.
Also, I think deserving some credit, the New Roadmap Foundation with Vicki Robin and the late Joe Dominguez.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting because they were doing this work for years. People all of a sudden think, oh, an overnight success. They were doing it for years. And I was at Joe Dominguez's memorial, and the people who got up to talk about how he had really, really changed their lives. And that's what you see in this movement, is this, it's like, oh, I see. This movement really talks a lot about what people are already thinking, but they don't know how to put it together. And suddenly they hear that phrase, voluntary simplicity, and it seems to bring it all together.
Now let's look at voluntary simplicity as lived by you. What kinds of things do you do without that perhaps the average home in America has? You do have a television. We talked about that.
We have a TV. And to me, the very crucial thing is that you find something in your life that is so much fun to do that you don't want to go shopping. You don't want to watch TV. You start, so it isn't even a difficult thing to cut back when you figure that out. In fact, you know, going shopping is like this huge intrusion into my life. And so it's never like a deprivation. But the thing about it is there are some things we've done automatically without thinking about them. For instance, it had never occurred to me to quit my full-time administrative job in a community college. You know, I'm in this good job. I should be moving up. That's what I'm supposed to do. And then you know how you have this kind of an experience. You walk through a bookstore and a book calls out to you.
Uh-huh.
And for me, it was downshifting. And it talked about how these people had taken a different path. Either they didn't want to move up. They worked part-time. They decided they wanted a less stressful job. And so I decided, I went in a sabbatical first. But because sometimes, you know, things aren't what you think they'll be. But the big thing was I would have never thought about quitting, as I eventually did, if I wouldn't have seen someone else do it. So you get these ideas that you never thought about. And another thing is when we moved into the house we're in now, there was already a separate apartment upstairs, but we just used it for our home offices. Well, being in this movement and reading and meeting people, I realized a lot of people were either moving into smaller homes or they were renting out part of their houses. And so that's what we're doing now. We're moving out of the top floor. And what we find is not only, you know, it's more financial security or just, you know, having people around. It's great because my husband and I, our kids aren't there. We're closer together. It's like you can have too much space. You can have too much privacy. So those are a couple of the things, but I still eat out all the time. I mean, some people, when they simplify their lives, want to cook all of their food. But I'd much rather be out in the neighborhood cafe, talking to friends, enjoying myself, you know, and not going home and thinking, oh God, the whole evening is cooking and cleaning.
But you don't have cable TV.
Well, we do have
cable TV.
Yes.
So I want to get a sense.
How would I see Larry Sanders if I didn't have cable TV?
I don't borrow tapes or something. No, but to get in a sense of family A, the Jones, typical American family has this. They have two cars. They have a two-car garage door opener, cable TV, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
what of that stuff do you do without? Do you find yourself doing
well, without? Well, another example, for instance, I don't have a microwave, I don't have a dishwasher. But again, it was like when we moved into this house, you know, we thought, oh yeah, we got to get a dishwasher. We'd always have a dishwasher. Well, going out to shop for a dishwasher isn't a whole lot of fun. And so, you know, you kept putting it off. And so then I realized that I was enjoying washing the dishes. It was like, it was reflective.
It was a zen thing, wasn't it?
It was. It was. And then, of course, I realized I didn't have very many dishes because I didn't do any cooking. So it was like pointless to have a dishwasher. But you see, I was going to do it automatically. I was going to do it automatically because that's what you do. So the big thing is we're not all going to look alike when we simplify our lives, because it's everyone thinking through for themselves. And, you know, I decided I always thought microwaves ruined the taste of something. And then I discovered that indeed they don't make things taste the same. And you know what people use microwaves for now?
Warming up leftovers?
Not even that. Warming up their cold coffee.
Yeah.
And so it's like we just automatically, you know, any new technology that comes along, we think we've got to have it because that's, so that's what it's this consciousness. It's critical thinking. It's being aware of what you're doing and not just responding automatically.
Yeah. We're talking with Cecile Andrews. She's the author of The Circle of Simplicity: Return to the Good Life. I'm Paul Nelson. We mentioned your epiphany, I picture you being in an auditorium hearing speakers, and a Native American speaker just said something that made you start weeping. Can you tell us that story?
Well, usually this was at our back to school fall convocation, and the president just talks and is like really boring. And so you have to go, everybody has to go. And so this time we had this Native American speaker talking about his education, how his grandfather would send him out to sit and watch the beavers all day. And at the end of the day, he would ask him, what did you see? What did you feel? And what did you learn? And it's like, everyone was in tears because he was so moving. But then you had to think, why wasn't my education like that? And then the next step, I as an educator, why wasn't I doing that kind of education? Because education today is primarily training people for jobs, and not necessarily jobs that they're going to love, jobs that they're going to make a lot of money so they can, you know, keep moving up.
Training them to be cogs in the machine.
Yes, exactly. And they're not giving them any, they're not saying, think about it. They're not saying, what is it you really love to do? They're filling slots for the corporations.
The work of Thoreau also, you mentioned earlier, kind of opened your eyes to voluntary simplicity. Can you tell us a little bit about his influence on you?
Well, there's one quote that I always, always love. And he said, I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. And it was like, even when I was 16 and read that, it's like, ah, that's it. And not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. And I think that is the motivating force of all this, is people don't feel alive. It's like everything is on the surface. Things don't have depth. People don't have deep friendships. You know, people don't sing and dance and spend time just sitting around and talking with people. So that's part of it. And then the study circle part is people getting together and having real conversations, talking about real things that matter to them. And most people don't do that.
Yeah, we haven't talked about the study circles, and I definitely want to talk about them. I get a sense, we talked a little bit about Seattle and how this quote-unquote movement, quote-unquote, started in Seattle, and perhaps the term voluntary simplicity refers to the Seattle movement or whatever, but I get a sense of you going on your book tour and people in New York telling you, you can do this in Sasquatch country, but this is something else in New York. What kind of response do you get outside the Pacific Northwest?
Well, you know, people have said this is a movement where people don't know there are other people in the same boat. And so I will get these. I got this letter the other day from this man who said, oh, God, you know, we need to have voluntary simplicity here. He says, you've never seen such a stressed out group of North Dakotans. And I'm thinking, North Dakota? He says, they really need your message. They're overworked here. And it was so funny. And I thought, oh, wow. I mean, and we did have a big response in New York. It was one of their biggest responses they'd had to a conference. And then my next place is Washington, D.C., and they've had a, you know, it's going to be at the Smithsonian, and they've already had a big sign up for it in Washington, D.C. So I think people are surprised at how many people are out there thinking these thoughts. Uh-huh.
That maybe they never heard of voluntary simplicity, but the message somehow resonates with them,
right,
and they're ready to hear it.
Right.